This is the Extra Hot Crate Podcast, episode 290 for the week of February 18th, 2020. I am Bogeyman David T. Cole, and I'm here with original Annie Sarah D. Bunting.
Like no business I know.
And blue miner Tara Ariano.
Let's smurf this bridge.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Extra Hot Crate. This is an advanced recording episode. There's a good chance that me and Tara have been eaten by lions by the time you hear this. We are somewhere in Africa taking pictures of lions and zebras and giraffes and stuff like that. If you're unfamiliar with our TV force innings, this is how it works. Each one of us in turn forces one in the chain to watch something on TV. They have no choice in the matter. Whatever is dictated by me to Tara, she must watch. And let's start there. I have forced Tara to watch an episode of The Smurfs called The Purple Smurf. An episode which I believe I talked about very briefly a few weeks ago on the podcast as something that sort of stuck in my head as a child when I watched it and kind of like creeped me out, which is kind of funny now to watch it because it's just dumb. But at the time, it inhabited the zombie fear zone of my head until I watched actual zombie films later on in life. So with that, let's throw it to Tara to talk about The Smurfs, The Purple Smurf.
All right. Well, as we begin, the Smurfs are building a bridge. The various Smurfs do various Smurf things, as we expect.
And how high are the Smurfs?
They're three apples high.
Got it.
Smurfette paints the bridge pink. Baker Smurf's shovel is all covered in, you know, goo from his various pastries, etc. Brainy fucks it up, and so Papa Smurf has to send Lazy Smurf out into the forest to chop some more logs. And so Lazy goes out into the forest to chop logs, and then clip one.
Ow! Ouch! It bit me!
So he turns purple. He turns purple, starts hopping up and down, just saying gnap, gnap like that. And by the way, the fly that bites him is also purple. And just in terms of relative size, I know that the animators of the 80s, like they had to pump out 500 episodes a year of these things. But at the time that it bites Lazy Smurf, originally when I was thinking about it, it was like, okay, imagine that a Smurf is the size of like a human. The fly is like the size of like a yoga ball. It's very, very large.
The fly is two apples high.
Yeah, basically. It's enormous. Yeah, it's bigger than a yoga ball. That's a terrible analogy. Anyway, it's huge at this point. So Lazy gets fly bit and he basically gets the rage virus. At the point that we were watching this episode, I said today, so this is basically 28 Smurfs later, and it is. So
I went with the walking Smurf.
Sure, if you will.
It would be the Smurfing Dead, actually.
Yes, you're right. I'm sorry.
They send Brainy into the forest after him. Brainy obviously gets freaked out and runs back toward where everyone else is working on the bridge, and clip two.
Lazy's over there, but he's all purple, and all he says is, "Gnap!"
Lazy's always talking about a nap.
Like this? Gnap!
Yay!
Yay!
So, the imitation alone is enough to creep out. I think that's Vanity Smurf. I can't remember. So Papa Smurf knows the cause. This happened when he was a very young Smurfling, barely 100 years old. He can't remember what the cure is. So they take patient zero, Lazy Smurf. They tie him up and then they just leave him in his little mushroom house. They post up Hefty Smurf outside the door, but he breaks his ropes and he gets out and then he bites Hefty. And by the way, every time someone gets bitten, they're getting bitten on their little Smurf tail that pokes out of their little Smurf pants, which by the way is adorable. But as I said when we were watching it, seems like basic protocol is cover your tail. This is where people are getting infected. But you know, it's a 13-minute episode. They don't get into the ins and outs of, you know, it's not the hot
right zone. Like all the Smurfs should be like decked out like they're from Mad Max.
Yeah. So Lazy bites Hefty. He gets infected. Brainy fucks everything up by claiming credit for one self-captured Smurf who was like tied up and then got infected. So then the count is off, which I thought was going to be a story point, but it doesn't matter because everyone just gets infected so fast. And none of Papa Smurf's attempted cures are working. The infection is spreading wildly. So he decides he's going to try and catch the purple fly. And then once he catches it, it shrinks down to like relative. If a Smurf was the size of a human, now it's like the size of a tennis ball. So, okay, whatever. But randomly he discovers that the cure is tuberose pollen. So he somehow, through methods, assembles as much tuberose pollen as he can, fills a bunch of bellows. All the uninfected Smurfs go out and try to, you know, just spray everybody. And it works, but it's not fast enough. The virus is spreading faster than the cure can cure people. Also, Hefty, while infected, is like still has enough consciousness to paint himself blue again and infiltrate, which is
part of the new trend of smart zombies.
Okay,
they're not George Romero undead enough. Zombies. They sort of have some sort of brain activity happening.
Yes.
Yes.
So ultimately,
ahead of its time.
Everybody gets infected, including Papa Smurf, who's had been the last holdout. But there's a fire starts in his mushroom house. Which causes the
apparati.
Yes, all of his various scientific things to whatever
explode.
And so the pollen cure gets dispersed through the whole village, and everyone inhales it, and then it's fine.
So the cure mm-hmm. that explodes in Papa Smurf's mushroom house
right.
is the same concoction that they put in the bellows a couple of minutes before, but the concoction in Papa Smurf's house blows up, forms a cloud, and then its own free will as a cure
sure.
floats out of the house, mm-hmm. stops at the first group of Smurfs,
yeah,
gives them a good dousing,
yeah,
then moves on to the next. So it has mobility where the bellow concoction did not, and it seems to have some sort of like like wayfinder capabilities. You're using waypoints to get from from infected node to infected node.
Yeah, you know, in the Simpsons episode with the flu epidemic where
yes.
there's the two clouds
the Osaka of flu.
They stop at an intersection and wait at the lights.
Yeah.
Same thing.
It's like that.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's the end of it. So then after that, we watched a little fan-made video that tied this back to the original comic book that this was based on from the 1960s, where originally what happened in this story was tug neck, shirt at neck. Awkward. Originally, the infected Smurfs turned black, and it was called the Black Smurfs, but apparently that version of the story has been wiped from history, and like now, when the book has been reprinted, when they made the cartoon, they turned them purple, wise, and the book has been reprinted as the Purple Smurfs as well. So, you know, good move, Belgium.
Right.
So. Yeah, Smurf face revelations can be extremely damaging.
Yeah, but actually, in the 80s, my parents had a Smurf, and we did too, I guess. We played with them, but we had a Smurf toy collection, like the little figurines, mm-hmm. and one of them was the Black,
oh,
the
really?
Black Smurf.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
That was a rare one. I guess we now know why. We didn't know the story. But yeah.
It must be Chimney Sweeper Smurf.
Who knows? There was a Chimney Sweeper
oh, was
Smurf.
There?
Yeah, it had a little
brush.
It
wasn't as black as Black Smurf?
No.
Oh.
So yeah, this was, I mean, I'm sure I watched this at the time, but it didn't
stick with you.
Penetrate the way it did
sure.
with you.
Yeah.
But was it as creepy as you remembered? I mean, no, obviously, but.
Obviously, I can cope with it now that I'm a big man.
Yeah.
But at the time, mm-hmm. you know, even to watch it now, you can understand why you might be creeped out
oh,
as
sure.
a kid, because here's all these very animated, very individualistically drawn characters, right?
Yes.
They're all one note things, right?
Right.
Jokey Smurf tells jokes.
Sure.
Yeah. So they all have a personality you can identify with, mm-hmm. asterisk. And then they're all robbed of that and they turn into these monsters that seem to have no mm-hmm. defense. You have no defense against. That said, the Achilles heel of all Smurf cartoons that I remember watching is that let me backtrack. In Smurf canon, there's like 100 so named Smurfs,
sure.
all with their trait, right?
Mm-hmm.
Painter Smurf, etc.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Including dumb ones like the Smurf kids and shit
right.
like that.
Yes.
And then on the cartoon, they often just have a whole bunch of generic Smurfs running around. They mm-hmm. have, you know, they don't have special hats, or they're not wearing their uniforms. Right. They're just like the red shirts of the Smurfs.
Yeah.
And I feel like if they really wanted world build, they should take the time to have all these Smurfs be actual Smurfs. They certainly have enough of them. Yeah. There is no scene where they needed more than 100 Smurfs mm-hmm. in any of these cartoons.
Well, may I posit this to you? In the 80s, no one cared about world building and shows for kids because they thought kids were dumb and would watch any old bullshit that was put in front of them.
They're not wrong.
And they were right.
It's just disappointing for a show.
No, for sure. Yeah. And you definitely can see the difference now when you watch like even shows that were for kids, like, you know, we watch Teen Titans Go, which obviously is more for tweens, but there's certainly more care taken in
populating,
you know,
the world.
Exactly. And, yeah. Yeah. I mean, The Simpsons, for all of its faults now, it certainly raised the game for what we expect even of an animated show.
Right. Exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get it.
Before we move on, I am surprised we're not hearing anything about division of labor or how the Smurfs make their money, the power structure of the Smurf village. Like, do we have any thoughts on that?
Did I think it was bullshit that the only thing the Smurfette does is paint the bridge pink and get knocked for it? Like, yes, of course. But like,
also, she has to wear heels in a collectivist work camp. Fuck out of here.
I mean, the origin story of Smurfette is also extremely sexist, too. Right. Like, that originally she just is, like, looks like a Smurf but has black hair, and then everyone's like, oh, no big deal. And then she gets, like, a Farrah Fawcett makeover and everyone's horny for her. Right. Like, blah.
So, yeah, this is basically Grease.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically.
Smurf Grease.
Exactly.
I think this is actually, like, given Dave's stated reason for picking this episode to forcing you with.
Yes.
This is an excellent example of stuff that, like, I always look at certain things that are for kids or were for kids, and I'm like, I would have been completely creeped out by that.
Yeah.
And then actual kids are like, what? Like, they don't care. Like, kids are, it's not that kids are tougher than we think or that we were tougher than we remember. It's that it's really random shit that used to freak us out. So I was not a Smurf guy back in the day, but I could see the Gnap hordes freaking me out also. But then like something like the Twilight Zone movie, like most of it was like, no, it's fine.
Yeah.
Not the girl with no mouth, but you know, the rest of it. And my parents were like, no, you can't watch that.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a weird thing.
Although I will say, when my nieces were younger, they used to not want to watch like new episodes of new shows that they didn't know. They preferred to rewatch like movies that they had watched a million times because they didn't want to be surprised by the stories. Like anytime there was suspense, they would interpret that, like they would feel that as fear.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes stuff even in kids' movies is scary, but sometimes it's just like, I don't know what's going to happen. And no matter how many times my sister would tell them, like, it's a Disney movie. Like,
but you know where
everything's going to be fine. Where?
That fear is from your sister's eating habits. They picked up on that and they don't want to watch anything new. They just want to eat, watch the same thing every day. Bread.
I mean, I can't judge her for that. You know, I eat the same thing every weekday.
Institutional start.
All right, shall we move on?
Yes.
Have I had tacos 6 nights out of the last 8? Yes, I have.
All right, so I forced Sarah to watch an episode of Encore. We talked about this briefly when Disney Plus launched and we had Adam Grossworth on to talk about The Mandalorian. Encore is the anthology show on Disney Plus where people who did a show, they've all been musicals, in high school, get back together as adults some number of years later and put the show on again on a much shortened timeline. And so, you know, reunite and see each other again sometimes for the first time since, you know, since they were in high school and relive all of that experience. And so I crammed in the first 8 episodes, all of the ones that had aired over our Christmas break. And when I got to the episode that I forced Sarah to watch, which is season 1, episode 5, Annie Get Your Gun, 1998, Satellite Beach, Florida, it was because after I watched that episode, there was a person in it that was the only thing I wanted to talk about for the rest of my life. And I still feel that way a month later. So, Sarah, I think you probably know who I'm talking about, but I'm going to turn it over to you. Let's talk about Encore.
Okay, first of all, I was sort of like, okay, this is a pretty good concept. And like, Kristen Bell doesn't tend to associate herself with stuff that I'm going to hate.
Right.
So this could be pretty interesting. But it became immediately clear, I assume, that we are talking about Lane.
Lane? No.
No?
No.
We're not.
Oh, no. No, no. We are talking about Amy, A-M-E-I-G-H.
Oh, yeah, that's... I mean, all right, look. Everyone involved is a lot because it's theater kids who have agreed to revisit being theater kids.
For sure.
And redo the show on like a 1 week deadline. This is completely crazy and manipulated, and you really see like... what a lot of high school musicals are working with, which is not a lot. Like that campaign strategist, I was like, oh my God, someone give that guy a bucket so he can carry a tune because this is scary. And then his own daughter was like, I'm really scared because I don't like to watch my dad dancing in public. It's embarrassing for everyone. Okay, so the original Annie in the production was played by Lane, who is one of those... whatever the like crystal wearing lady equivalent of the old guy at the club is.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's her.
Mm-hmm.
She's in like a jam band. I actually have a couple of clips, and this comes about 10 minutes into the episode. Dave, could you play clip one?
In my mind, there was absolutely no question that that was my role. If I hadn't been cast as Annie, I more than likely probably would have dropped out of high school.
You know what? I can see why you were Annie Oakley, too. The spirit in you and...
Annie Oakley and I are kindred spirits. It's like a umbilical cord that connects through space and time.
Okay.
I had to leave in the little sprink at the end.
Yeah.
So... she is a lot, but they come back in and there's a period at the beginning. I assume this is like pretty standard to all the episodes. I'll find out because I'm going to be cramming this one in.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with the show now. Uh-huh. Welcome, Tara. There is a moment where the music director and the director, both of whom in this episode are delightful. They're mm-hmm. like really positive, but occasionally someone cuts an eye to the camera, and there's a moment. The actual performance was so nerve-wracking for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was really very afraid for these people, and there's one moment where you cut to the orchestra pit, someone has missed their cue,
mm-hmm.
and the guy's like, oh no.
Yeah.
Love and then that guy. The caption says, oh no. Very
yeah,
cute.
We should say that they are helped with like real Broadway like directors and choreographers and music people, and then they get ringers who are performers like to fill out the minor roles as well.
Right. So Amy, A-M-E-I-G-H,
mm-hmm.
Her given name is Amy, but Andrea Zuckerman style, she decided to change it because it made her different.
Mm-hmm.
This is a medical doctor. She's mm-hmm. an OBGYN. Mm-hmm. Presumably she's, you know, of some accomplishment, who is still roll mad that the guy who played the male lead, whose name is Alfie in real life, I guess cheated on her 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And has also decided that the way to work through this in this milieu is to announce for the role of Annie herself, which she does not get, even though she has come to auditions in cowboy boots and a leather cowboy hat.
Mm-hmm.
There is... next to the word brittle in Merriam-Webster, there is a little woodcut of Amy not working through her shit in therapy. And she repeatedly brings up being cheated on by Alfie, who, I mean, my notes read, girl, I'm sorry he cheated on you with another boy, but you were in the play. What did you expect? Apparently this is not what happened. And like, can you take that personally? No, apparently that's not what happened. She is intent on getting closure on this issue. So, but like says nothing. She's just brittle towards kind of everyone. Finally, Alfie, probably prompted by the producers, calls her aside to talk about it. And he's like, I feel like there's something that you're upset about that you're not talking about. She's like, nope, everything's fine. It's just a lot. And then we hear clip two.
I know.
It's really good to see you, though. It's been a very, very long time.
Yeah. Out of all of the relationships with the cast members, I just figured ours was the most tumultuous at the
complicated?
End. At the end, complicated. But I just wanted to, I guess, make sure there wasn't, like, super animosity from back in the day.
I don't have any animosity toward you. You broke my heart, but...
Crying.
Life has definitely changed a lot of stuff. But
I guess I never really just understood what happened.
I mean, high school happened. That's what happened, you know.
I thought we were more than high school.
Ooh.
You are a medical doctor who delivers babies.
She's married a whole other man and had a child with him, and he's going to watch this.
And then they sort of try to make it about her relationship with her late father and like her late father's relationship with Alfie and sort of like the... believing in herself via like her father being proud of her and that being like transmogrified into the person of Alfie.
Yeah.
And, like in an attempt, I think, to provide some cover for her still being extremely like third degree burn raw about high school, which what was the line? And, Clerks, like high school is algebra and infidelity or whatever it is, like the, like get over it, really.
Yeah.
Oh my God. It was so painful. Mm-hmm. And yet I look forward to mainlining the rest of the season to see if there are awkward moments like that. But overall, it's a really well-constructed show and it sort of mashes all of my buttons in terms of like, there's just enough process. There's just enough awkwardness. There's just enough judgment opportunities. Mm-hmm. So this was an excellent pick. Did I miss anything that you wanted to talk about regarding Aimee?
Oh, yes, of course. First of all, the reason that she decided to change her name from AMY to AMEIGH is that it was Alfie's suggestion in high school.
Oh, right. Yeah, he wrote it like as a joke on a note that he put
in her locker. Well, he said, you know, yes, she just thought the Andrea Zuckerman comparison is very apt because she's like, I just thought to set myself apart, I would spell it that way, you know, just to be different. Yeah. But yeah, but also at the end, you know, as all of the loved ones and the audience and stuff are going in, we get to see, you know, the cast members, spouses and stuff, and we see Amy's husband and he goes it's really been special for her to be reunited with her first love, pause, the theater. It's like, oh buddy,
yeah.
I hope she did not have a viewing party for this, and if so, I hope she briefed you on like what actually happened, because otherwise, he got ambushed, and that was not okay. And I don't know how oblivious she is, if she would like have any sense of how she would come off in this. I feel like based on what we saw, she might not realize it was very bad. So, I mean, I kind of just want to know everything about her from now on.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. It just really, I mean, in the case of Lane, like Lane is sort of a known theater kid quantity.
For sure.
My school had one like this. Mm-hmm. If Matthew Ehrlich is within sound of my voice, he knows exactly who I'm talking about. Like she showed up on a Buffy episode in the band one time and I was like, and now we've reached peak name. So mm-hmm. she's like, if there's a microphone in the room, it's mine. Mm-hmm. And then she gets a look and you're like, no one is getting between you and a microphone, Lane. Trust me. Cause we know, we know what you are. And so do you. And that's fine.
Yeah.
Amy does not see or is not admitting to herself that, because Lane is like, you know, it pretty much like lists the things that are important to her and being the center of attention is first and her kid is second.
Right.
Not a lot of people will just put that out there. I think mm-hmm. it's true for more people than would admit it, but
for sure. Yeah.
She's just like, well, yeah, she's cool and all, but it's nothing compared to singing in front yeah. of people. Like, okay.
Well, yeah. It's a good season. I mean, it's definitely a mixed bag. And in terms of like, if you thought the singing was rough in this one, like the season premiere, which is Annie, not Annie Get Your Gun, just like Annie, the depression musical. Oof, there's a lot to love in that one too. But this one, I had to go with Amy because, you know, she's the most interesting man in the world as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah.
I like the idea that the byline or the subhead for Annie is the depression musical exclamation point.
Right. Well, you know.
Put it on the poster.
Yeah. I'm glad you didn't hate it, most of all.
I am up last in terms of forcenings, and I forcened Dave to watch Daybreak, Season 1, Episode 1, Josh versus the Apocalypse, Part 1. I said a mouthful. This is a sort of American Vandal meets The Walking Dead thing that past guest of the show, Jeb Lund, suggested that I watch. And I looked at the first like 5 minutes and was like, I think I'm going to force in Dave to watch this on the off chance that he has read the graphic novel it's based on and see what he thinks of it. So, Dave, what did you think of it?
I did not know that this was based on a graphic novel. The first 5 minutes are very Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I feel like that was mm-hmm. a vibe they were going for, at least at the start. I mean, to set it up, there is a character, Josh from Toronto, who just migrated to Glendale, California in LA. And a bomb goes off that presents as a nuclear bomb, but actually was some sort of biological bomb that somehow only kills adults. One of those bombs, you know, the adult bomb.
Yeah. Sure.
And
Logan's Run bomb
turns LA into a version of the episode of Futurama where kids run LA, but still have to go to Hebrew school at night. LA is turned into a whole bunch of fiefdoms. There's the jocks, you know, from high school, the jocks run this part, the Kardashian girls run this part, that kind of thing. And Josh is your everyday dude who just wants to find a girl he had a crush on in high school before the bomb went off. They were sort of like disaster buddies in the disaster buddy system at school. And the first episode is just setting the table for what this world is and him trying to find it. The main thrust of it is a run-in with the subset of the jocks, the golf jocks, who are all named Barry and Larry. And the problem with this show is I know exactly what they are trying to do. Like, I can imagine it on paper, but the execution of this show is just like off on like every little bit. Like the Ferris Bueller Day stuff doesn't come effortlessly, which is it. If it doesn't, it doesn't work. Like in Ferris Bueller, you believe that Matthew Broderick is Ferris Bueller and he's this dick of a kid that just gets his way all the time because he's just figured out how to game the system.
We should also note that Broderick is in it.
Yes.
As the principal.
Yeah.
Which is like, on the one hand, it's sort of a nice like nod to the fact that he was in this and Election and that we'll get a certain adult subset of the audience. But on the other hand, like if you're going to make that reference, I agree with you, Dave, like it has to be less labored and less pointedly meta fourth wall breaking.
This is like everything about the show is trying a little bit too hard to nail what it's trying to do down. And it's not giving itself to sort of loosen up and be that sort of effortless, almost breathless fun time. Like what they needed to do with this show is take what they have, give everybody a little bit of cocaine or marijuana or something, reshoot it, but then inject into his DNA 20% of crank. the movie with Jason Statham, because it needed a bonkers angle to what was going on, because they treated the apocalypse as a very matter of fact, and that doesn't really play, because they have characters that, like, there's a character that's supposed to be basically pyrotechnic hit girl, and she doesn't have the requisite amount of teeth to pull that off. Like, it's a whole bunch of things like that that get a halfway or three quarter mark to the trope or the characterization that they're going for, but it doesn't get there. And the fact that Matthew Broderick as the principal is in the show highlights that disparity, because he knows what he's doing. He's hitting his mark. His character isn't anything special. I didn't watch episode two, but I assume he is the Baron Von Terrible or whatever the hell that was.
Yeah.
When you have him against this youth cast, it's just, no offense to all the young actors, but they're just not on the level Matthew Broderick is. And he brings this sort of weird little, he's a principal, but he's also got this like impish quality to him, just like under the surface, that is enjoyable. But like, the show just can't run. It's not firing in all cylinders. And it's disappointing because, you know, the premise is okay. Nothing we haven't seen before. It is sort of like somewhere between Battle Royale and The Walking Dead or something like that. Like, it's got influences that you can see from Ferris Bueller. I would say
Warriors.
Warriors. Exactly. Yeah. You can see the ingredients. It's just, you don't got yourself a stew is what I'm saying.
Yeah. The problem for me was largely in the casting, and perhaps I'm prejudiced because the main guy, Josh, is played by Colin Ford, who is from Under the Dome.
Yeah, sorry, buddy.
But I do think like a lot of this would have been put over if the characters had like just were more charming, if the actors were more charming. And I think that's like where you see the gap the most with Matthew Broderick and the rest of the cast, is that like, obviously we already know him from, you know, years of being on our screens. Like, we know him and like him, and who are all these young punks, who cares? But they just, there's a real charisma gap, and you can, I know it's hard to cast kid and teen characters, but you can get it right, and you can always tell when they've done it.
Yeah.
I will say though, that this is like a very different take on, it's like that show, The Society, that we watched.
Oh yeah. Right.
Like that was so dour. That was kind of a similar thing, and obviously was also for teens, which like this is too, this is not for any of us. But at least this is trying to be, take a similar kind of premise and have fun with it, but it just seemed like its tone was all over the place.
It was, and I don't think it had really anything to say either. Like, what were the issues or things they were tackling? It, like, they could have done consumerism, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in the acquisition of post-apocalyptic goods and whatnot, which, you know, obviously everybody's doing that. They could have done a whole bunch of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Tribalism, cliques in high school, that kind of stuff. Like, nothing is really explored.
Yeah.
Like, I realize this is the pilot and they're just showing you what the world is like now.
Sure.
That said, it's sort of like driving in a stick shift. Like, the show gets going in the post-apocalyptic world and they're getting somewhere, and then they shift back to like a flashback to just before everything goes to shit, and it stalls every time they do that. Like, it is not a satisfying time jump.
Yeah.
Somebody's like heavy on the brakes
when
you're driving the car. It was kind of annoying. I can see why they made it a TV show. I can see on paper why it would sell itself. It just doesn't seem...
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like they had all the pieces to make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to read it, but this was like, I also felt like they didn't commit fully. Like, there are parts of it that are just like, in terms of the world building, like, not to be that guy, but it's like, I do want to know how these minor children are managing to eat and have clean clothes, and where does the power come from?
Yes.
Because clearly it's still...
Where are they getting their haircuts?
Yes.
Yeah.
Everybody has amazing hair in this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then instead of giving us little snippets about that, they'll have Josh sort of talking to camera about flashback tropes and cliffhanger tropes. And it's like, just because you're calling it out doesn't mean it's cute.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's the Family Guy
problem. To the fucking reveal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Like, they, it's sort of like they thought the big idea or the, you know, the log line or what sold it in the room is like, what if Ferris Bueller survived the into the post-apocalypse? Right. But the problem is like the reason that character like Ferris Bueller works is that like he is comfortable. Like there are no stakes in his story. He's fine. He's like a white kid in Evanston. You know what? Like his future's secure. He can fuck around like this because like, because he's fine, you know what I mean? And so that's like the reason that for me, what was so off-putting about it, like right from the start, is that like, oh, it's gross that Josh is being this glib about this horrible situation that he's in. Like, even if you grant, like, well, it's been 6 months, he's had a chance to get used to it, it's still like, right, he's potentially in mortal peril all the time.
The problem is, like, I wouldn't mind if he was glib about it, but the show doesn't make a decision about where it's going. Is it a black comedy?
Right.
Right? That would work in that case.
Like Last Man on Earth.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it went dark and kind of cartoon violent,
right,
then that take could have worked.
Right.
But they're like right down the middle and they're not going hard in any one direction. And it just feels, because of that, kind of lifeless in the middle. And it's like, it's just one of those shows. I feel like, I don't know anything about the making of it, but it kind of feels like by committee.
Yeah. I agree.
And I also, now that we're talking about it, like, if you're going to cast Matthew Broderick in something like this, I kind of feel like you need to let it be known that he is actually David Lightman from War Games in Witness Protection, and you need to do something with that. And in fact, the universe just needs to do something with that. I'm not a crackpot.
Yeah, War Games was good.
It was.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. Dave forced Tara to watch The Smurfs, Tara forced Sarah to watch Encore, and Sarah forced Dave to watch Daybreak. We are still friends. Remember!
We're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
we smurfed it!
And Sarah D. Bunting.
Rhyming? Really, Gary?
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time, right here, on Extra Hot Great.
Yikes!